Hello, everybody. Welcome to Theater Schmooze, where we chat with Jewish theater makers from around the world about their art, Judaism, and vision for theater's future. I'm your host, Danielle Levski. This podcast is brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater, a nonprofit organization made up of theater artists, theaters, and other people connected to theater to promote the creation, presentation, and preservation of both traditional and non-traditional theatrical endeavors by, for, and about the Jewish experience. Today we'll be talking with Lila Rose Kaplan, who is a playwright and writer based in Somerville, Massachusetts. It is such an honor to have you as a guest in our show today, Lila.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah. I wanted to get us started off by talking about a recent production of yours that went up at the Barker Street Playhouse in Providence, Rhode Island, Catching Flight. So from my research, the last time it was put on was at the Camden Fringe Festival in 2011. Mm-hmm. How did it feel for you having it put up again this time? Did it feel any different for you? Were there moments that perhaps that you noticed now that weren't present before?
You know, the whole experience was actually kind of wild because it's a play that I wrote in San Diego in my mm-hmm. first year of grad school. So that was like 15 years ago. And it's a play about two sisters, and it's at three different moments in their lives. So they're kids, they're in their 20s, and they're in their 40s. And I very much wrote it when I was in my 20s. And all the productions of it I've seen had two actresses in their 20s-ish, you know, playing these three ages. And now I'm the age of the oldest. Now I'm in my 40s, early 40s. And I went to see this production, and they had interestingly cast it with women who were in their 60s, who played all the ages, but weren't in any of the ages. And it was so beautiful. There was something so incredible about it. You know, my daughter, who's 7, saw it. And so it was something very coming full circle about it. And one of my first productions I've seen since COVID. So it was really, it was quite an extraordinary experience.
Oh my gosh, that's so wonderful and so special. What made the director, or maybe it was you said, made the decision to cast the actors in a higher age bracket?
You know, it actually wasn't me. It was one of the two actresses was in a scene study class, and someone had given her a scene from Catching Flight, and they did it. And it went so well that they decided to put on a whole production of it. So they asked me if it would be all right to do it with the older actresses, and I thought that was awesome. I love older ladies on stage. So I thought it would be such a cool way to really make it about how we're always all the ages we are, you know?
Totally. Were there any moments that felt like they resonated more strongly because there were older actors on the stage?
I mean, the kid part was just so beautiful. And to see these two incredible actresses, like connecting with their inner like 5-year-old and 8-year-old and not making fun of or playing down to, but really just like finding that inherent kid energy that we actually all still have, but usually a lot of adults lose their connection to it. I mean, you as a clown know that, you know, like it's in there, but you have to kind of bring it up and nurture it. And I loved it. I loved how they did it. And there are also these moments of repetition through the show mm-hmm. where like the same lines are said or the same moments are had at different ages. And there was something really beautiful about that. But you could imagine them having it when they're older too, since you're seeing them as older.
Wow. Yeah, that's wonderful. To go back to what you were saying about recognizing your inner child as you grow older, I feel like in particular, it's really hard for people in their 20s to do that, because they're entering adulthood in a very real way mm-hmm. and are often very keen to prove how much of an adult they are. And so pushing away the inner child is unfortunately really present in your 20s. I think mm-hmm. as you get older, you realize that it's more essential than ever to incorporate childlike play and wonder into your life.
I totally agree. When I was in my late 20s, a lot of people told me I had a great voice for young audiences, and I wanted to be a serious playwright, you know, who wrote for adults. And I have been, but I've also in the last 5 years written some plays for kids, and it has been such a wonderful experience. And they've gone on, one was at ART, and then it went off Broadway in New York. I mean, they've had these great lives because my voice does live in that space between childhood and adulthood. And one of my favorite directors accuses me of writing children's plays for adults. So I think I do kind of cross that bridge, and it's been beautiful to like re-enter it, especially now that I'm a mom. It's really cool.
What was the impetus for you to start writing plays that were more geared towards children?
You know, there's this amazing story called The Light Princess that was written like in the 1800s. It was written by Lewis Carroll's mentor and George MacDonald. And it's about this princess who's cursed to have no gravity. And I have loved this story since I was a kid. And I always thought it would make such a cool musical. And I guess I found the right composer for it. And I was in a good headspace for it. And so we had such a fun time writing it. And it's so theatrical. You know, I started in dance also, to have this place where like she had to float the whole time, which is such a wonderful, magical challenge. And I'm really into like, how can we as theater artists make things that are very specifically for the theater? Because like TV and movies are awesome, right? You know, so like, I think making something where we're watching her fly or be flown was so beautiful.
That's wonderful. It seems that you've been adapting a lot of work in the past few years. In particular, I saw in 2020, you had the production Small Enchantments go up. And I saw your interview with director John Blondell and how you were kind of talking about really enjoying fairy tales, really enjoying adaptation and enjoying making something meaningful during that time. I was curious, after, you know, more than 2 years, how do you reflect back on the time and the work you created during it in the pandemic?
So that was such an adventure. John, who you mentioned, is a wonderful director and a incredibly energetic and unusual man. And he called me July of 2020. So we're all still in like the beginning throes of what has now become normal. And I was in a little bit of a theater funk because I'd had a huge production close like February 20th, 2020. And so I think I was still like in that weird space we all get into where you have to move between shows, but there wasn't another show. John called me and he said to me, the world needs to be re-enchanted right now. And that's what you do with your plays. And I'd love for you to write our fall show. He runs the Westmont College Theater Program. And he said, I don't know if it's going to be inside, outside, or on Zoom. And it was a crazy proposition. I had to write this play in like 4 weeks, but for John, I'll do almost anything. So, and I had this idea to adapt The 12 Dancing Princesses, which is a fairy tale I've loved since childhood. And I figured it was a college show, so there'd be a million women who wanted to be in it. And if it was monologues, I thought they could be on Zoom, they could be outside, they could be wherever. Mm-hmm. And it's like one of the few fairy tales where women are actually doing something. Like these like young women, I don't know if you know the story, but these young women are like sneaking out every night to go dancing. And I feel like there's such a great agency in that. They're forbidden to leave the palace. And of course, the original fairy tale doesn't end well for them. But I love the beginning of it. And then we found a new ending for our princesses. I loved it. I think fairy tales have these like, I don't know, like the DNA of the stories we all carry in different ways. And I think there's a way everyone like relaxes a little bit and leans forward when they know something like a fairy tale is coming their way. And we wrote these much more contemporary, well, it started sort of old fashioned, it became more contemporary as it went through. Mm. And of course, I'm a playwright, I got through 5 monologues and then suddenly I was writing scenes. So they did like, they did become some were scenes and some were monologues. And in the end, they did it on Zoom. And it was so cool because they also got this amazing artist, Julia, who's Russian, who drew like, I think she drew like 1,000 images. And so a lot of the moments were like seeing the girls, but they had like these images over near them or like the transitions. It was so beautiful. And I wish more people had done that in Zoom because suddenly it wasn't, you were just like watching a play on your computer. You were watching this thing that was sort of a piece of 2D and 3D art at the same time. So a long way of saying, I think fairy tales are amazing. And I go back to them sort of implicitly and explicitly, I think, when I create theater.
Wow, that's wonderful. Yeah, I agree with you that not a lot of productions took advantage of the new things that they could explore with Zoom, especially visual art. So that's really wonderful to hear that there was like these really lovely drawings incorporated throughout the production. What about We All Fall Down? I think you also worked on that one in 2020. How did that production fare for you?
Well, that was like just before the end. That was that play opened like January 11th and closed. It extended twice, so it closed February 15th, I think. You know, that play wasn't touched by COVID, except that it was the last thing I did before COVID started. And it was the last thing a lot of people saw in my community, which was also interesting. Like a lot of my parent friends have said to me, that was our last date before we stopped, you know, and now of course the world is opening up for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I love that play. I worked on that play on and off for 10 years. Sort of my like coming out as a Jewish playwright, Jewish person play. It's based in part on my family and it's about a family of cultural Jews in Westchester, New York, attempting their first Passover Seder. So it's looking at this very ancient ritual and this group of people who don't know a lot about it, trying to bring it back to life. And it's very funny and very heartbreaking, like a lot of my plays are. It kind of spans the whole world of what you can feel. And, you know, because it's autobiographical in some ways, I think I had to work on it and then take a break and work on it. And you know, I think I had to come in and out of it. But as a result of that, it kind of grew up with me as a playwright. I started it in my late 20s and it got produced in my late 30s. So I feel like there was this amazing, I don't know, I'm very fond of this play. You know, I went to the Seder at my parents' house. And like I said, we didn't grow up very religiously. My dad did, my mom didn't, and then we didn't. And it was just like, usually there was like some like, what I think of like official Jew at the Seder's at my parents' house. And for some reason, none of them could come that year. Like my boyfriend, now husband, his grandma was sick and someone else had to do the conference, whatever it was. No one really knew what they were doing. And it was it was complicated. And a lot of people had opinions about if we should be doing it, how we were doing it, got into Israel-Palestine. Like it kind of went through the whole gamut of the stuff around the Seder without, you know, the Seder having its own momentum. And it was also very funny. And I got home after it and I told this story to Jarrett, who I'm now married to. And he was like, that's a play. I was like, it's not a play. It's just my crazy family. He's like, I think it's a play. Just write the first scene. And of course, like it ended up being like the most successful and play I'm proudest of that I've written, you know, so I think it is. There is something, and so many people came up to me after the show of all backgrounds being like, I have that same thing where I don't feel Catholic enough. I don't feel Muslim enough. Like, I think we all have this funny sense that we aren't doing it right. And it was so amazing for me to hear that. I gave a toast opening night and I said, I think the most Jewish thing I've ever done is write a play about not feeling Jewish enough, because it just like resonated so loudly with everyone. And it reinforced for me the importance of theater as a ritual where we can come together and see ourselves in stories. And also these Jewish or religious rituals that may be outdated in ways we may need to update them to be more inclusive. But the fact that they're forcing us to gather does create a new moment for a family and a new energy and a chance for everyone, maybe in tough ways, to like grow together and see each other in new ways. And then because this play happened and was so well received, I've then gotten all of these opportunities to like write as a Jewish playwright.
Oh, wow.
So it like launched me into this new moment. And we can talk more about it, but I'm working on this wonderful commission right now with Theater J, which is a big Jewish theater in DC. And I don't know, it's been really, I've done some other interviews, like it's just been a really lovely way. And concurrently, we joined a temple in the beginning of COVID. I've been like very temple resistant my whole life.
Yeah.
There was a branch of my family that was in the kind of communist, like religion is the root. That's, you know, organized religion is the problem. And my very patient and wonderful husband, we tried temple after temple in all the cities we've lived in. And finally, he found one here in Boston that has like two kick-ass lady rabbis. There's like people of all faiths create the music. Like there's just a way, like at Rosh Hashanah, the first thing they did was read a poem about women. I was like, fine, you got me. And it's been a beautiful place to be, called PBZ in Brookline. Mm. They really created what to me is a very welcoming space, regardless of how you grew up or what you know. Yeah, so I don't know. It's been really lovely and interesting that my art and my life are both looking more to Judaism right now as part of like what lights them.
Mm-hmm. Just to confirm, you were saying that this particular play, that was your first Jewish play, right?
It was my first play about explicitly Jewish themes. I mean, you know, I think like, there is something inherently Jewish in my humor.
Sure.
And in my totally complicated way of seeing the world and telling stories. I once got a response to one of my early plays from some fancy professional person. They were like, you know, your writing is amazing, but this play is too totally complicated. I wanted to be like, isn't your life totally complicated?
Yeah, like, of course.
And I'm really glad I didn't let that shut me down and send out places that were more interested in what I was doing. Like, as we're talking, I'm looking at my office wall here and there are all of these Chagall images up, which are for this civic play I'm working on. And it was so lovely to kind of get to know his stuff better and realize that this is like a tradition we have of like something could be beautiful and funny and sad all in the same sentence. And that's actually captures the moment. So yeah, it was my first explicitly Jewish piece. I think I've had, I have a play called The Magician's Daughter that I wrote after I started We All Fall Down, but it got produced before We All Fall Down did. And that has aspects of Judaism in it, but it isn't, I wouldn't say it's like explicitly a
Jewish,
and not as, I mean, it kind of is a kind of, I don't know. It's a totally complicated thing to explain, but it is probably, it was getting there probably.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, I'm sure we can look at every single one of your works and find Jewish storytelling within it because it's part of who you are. But it's interesting that the first very explicitly Jewish play was about a family trying to enact Jewish tradition and not feeling very secure or confident about it. Because like you said, I think everybody has that approach to everything we are, everything we do, our identity, especially carrying tradition, right? Tradition is passed down orally, meaning it's never passed down exactly as it was in the previous generation, the generation before that. And then of course we have all these new ideas every couple of years, every second really within our world. So thinking about that combined with the game of telephone that is tradition, I think it's a really interesting thing to explore.
No, it's so fascinating. You know, I grew up in Westchester, which has a lot of Jews, and everyone I knew was more observant than we were, or than I was. So I always sort of thought of myself as like a token non-religious Jew. And then I moved to New York City, where like the entire city is that on some level. And so, but then when I moved to San Diego for grad school, it was Rosh Hashanah, and I had this like feeling I had to do something. And it was like a welcome happy hour for new, I don't know. So I went to this happy hour and I brought a plate of apples and honey and just stuck it out where everything else was. And someone said, oh, what's that for? And I looked around. And I was like, oh my God, am I going to be the person who knows this and explains it? And it was this very new role for me to kind of be the person that was, you know, the next one in the game of telephone to explain what was happening. So I don't know. I've come to really love that. And, you know, I still have my insecurities around it. And I still sometimes need to be very distant from it. But there's a way it is now, I say, a core ingredient of who I am.
Yeah. I forgot which Talmudic reading this is from, but it stuck with me, I think, for the past 10 years at least. Oh, I think actually it's commentary by Rashi, somewhere at the beginning of the Torah, where it says that Jewish people are like the moon because we wax and wane towards our belief, towards our understanding, towards our security, towards our assurance in our tradition, in God, in everything that we do with our identity. Which I always thought was really, really apt because like talking to you and talking to everybody I've talked to on this podcast, the relationship to Judaism is always one that's kind of complicated and is stronger sometimes and softer other times. And it's always complicated.
Well, it's interesting because I think we all fall down with me like sort of walking out and being like, this is complicated. And then Leah and her Dybbuk, which is a play I'm working on now, I think is where I really like...
Yeah.
And having a lot of those arguments within the play about the parts of Judaism, you know, the more sexist parts, the not as welcoming of people who aren't straight parts, sort of like the, I don't know, there's a way that like it opens something in me. And if like we all put down with my child Jew play, this is more of like my adolescent, like, I'm going to tell you all the reasons I'm mad at you, mom. You know, like here are all the things. And it's been really beautiful to have a space to work on that that is welcoming of it. I mean, Theater J has been great to have help me develop this play and bring it into being, especially during the pandemic.
Totally. So this is a part of their Yiddish theater project, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the Dybbuk has been told in so many different ways over its entire existence. I think it's interesting because you had a sort of coming out as a Jewish playwright, and now you're telling a queer feminist retelling of the Dybbuk. I just think that's funny.
Yeah, I like coming out. Come out in lots of ways.
Yeah. AJT's virtual conference is coming up on Sunday, October 23rd and Monday, October 24th. The yearly conference has been virtual for the past 3 years, which has allowed us to gather folks from all over the world to witness panels and performances and participate in workshops and affinity groups with award-winning speakers, international panelists, and current and future theater leaders and stars. Our theme this year is Revive and Renew, stepping into our Jewish identity and the world with greater empathy and awareness. We're featuring keynote speakers like Carrie Perloff and Arlene Goldbard, plus hosting workshops and panels with folks like Moses Kaufman, Stefan Naknonovich, Joshua Hirschfeld, and more. Head over to our website, alljewishtheater.org, to get your tickets today. So we talked a little bit earlier about fairy tales and story retelling and adapting stories. And then you also mentioned that there, you know, unfortunately is a lot of aspects of Judaism that are quite sexist, quite homophobic. It's an ancient religion and the thoughts towards different ways of living have adapted over the years. But in portraying queerness through the lens of the super classic tale, what has been a sort of an alarming discovery for you or something that was like, oh my gosh, I never thought about it this way before because I've never looked at it through this feminist queer lens before?
So to do my research for Leah and her Dybbuk, I interviewed 24 Jewish women of all different backgrounds and amounts of religiousness and theater, not theater, scholar, not scholar, a whole mix of people. There was a week where I was interviewing all these rabbis and I come down for lunch. It's an early COVID. Whenever I was working at home, I'd come down for lunch and my husband would be like, did you have a bat mitzvah this morning? Like, are you a rabbi yet? You know, I sort of was getting this like, huge education like on Zoom in my interviews. I don't know if it was alarming, but it was definitely like exciting and heart opening to realize how different these 24 women were and how in my like simplistic way of thinking that, they were just all people that were more Jewish than I was. like would come out by talking to them, I'd be like more legitimate to write this play. And everyone had such complex and beautiful thoughts. You know, I asked questions. I asked if people knew what a Dybbuk was or if they knew the story. I asked people's like favorite three elements of a Jewish wedding. And I asked, you know, I explained my experience where I said, you know, growing up, what I experienced was that women were not the ones doing the rituals and women were not like really fully included in from what I could observe at the temples I would go to. And that has for a long time been a barrier to entry for me. But now that I have a child and I want her to have a tradition, I'm like finding new ways. And I asked them kind of what their experience was with that was. And it was just so, I mean, I kind of hope someone publishes these interviews someday, because it was just amazing to hear survivors, people who grew up speaking Yiddish, people who grew up not religious and then found it later. Like this thing that we call Judaism is like 8,000 million things, you know, and it was kind of freeing and exciting to see that. And also what was sometimes alarming to me is that some of the more observant women who I admire and look up to a lot, it felt to me had these big blind spots where they just would like, you know, well, it's okay that, you know, my daughter can't do this thing because she's actually very shy, so she wouldn't want to, or these things that to me where I was like, but that shouldn't be the, you know, that's to me, that's a little red flag around like, but what are other things than what are we teaching half the population about their, you know, right to exist? Yeah. And I heard this story, I feel like in like the last 5 years or so, although time's gotten so weird with COVID, it might have been the last 10, about like an old man who was like throwing rocks at little girls in Israel going to school. And it was like an article in the New York Times. That has just stayed with me, where I was like, how can we like believe in something that would ever create someone that would do that? You know, like, how could like my most, you know, core feminist child protector self is like, I just don't want any part of something that would create that scenario. And of course, life is not that black and white, but it was it was really, I don't know, I grew so much through those interviews. And it's interesting because there are a few lines from the interviews in the play, but really the essence of those interviews has infused itself into the play. And the play has this chorus of seven women who tell the story. And it is so beautiful to hear this, you know, very male-dominated story retold by women. And and I'm just so excited for it to find its way into the world and you know, be another version of that story that starts to even out how we think about it more.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think it's a very bold and necessary time to be investigating all fairy tales in this way, right? Sometimes me, Dybbuk feels like a fairy tale because it has such magical elements to it. But asking each other the questions of who wrote these fairy tales, who were they for? Not just who wrote these fairy tales, but like who had the ability to be in the room when these fairy tales were created? And then who had to then regurgitate these fairy tales to future generations? Most of the time, the regurgitating was done by women, but the stories were frequently written by men or members of the patriarchy.
Well, and a big wake-up call for me and a growing moment for me was also thinking about race and the stories and how to be more inclusive. You know, like one of the two rabbis at our temple is African-American, and I've been doing this big DEI training there, and Theater J in D.C. is very committed to representing Jews of color on stage. And Adam, who used to be the artistic director, said to me, he's like, if this is a play about including who didn't get to be included, and you're including women and queer people, like you're leaving out a whole section. And it, you know, like a slow white person, it took me a little while to get there, but I'm really there now about, oh, we have to see the whole, if we're going to see the whole picture, we have to see the whole picture. And so that's something that I've been thinking a lot about and cooking on.
Yeah. And so that's a part of Leah and her Dybbuk too, as well.
Yeah. We've been workshopping it with people of all different races and kind of trying on how the story plays out. And that's been exciting. And you asked about like as a queer piece, I think I'm still coming into myself as someone who's out. Like I've been bi, I've been non-binary probably my whole life, but and my immediate world knew that. But there's something about like letting it live in this play that is so exciting. And also that might be the alarming or terrifying thing for me, is that like I'm you know, letting it out of me and into the world. And in the original story, Leah, or at some point we'll call her Leah, has this best friend. And in my version, it's a love story between them. And that slowly unfolds as it goes. That might have been a spoiler, but it's okay. But I think to angle it that way, like, validates an entire part of my existence that I haven't ever sort of shown light on before. So that is both exciting and alarming at the moment.
For sure. I can totally see that. But I think it's wonderful because it's so necessary for us to have queer representation, particularly in this way in Judaism. I think There has been incredible work done amongst gay men in the Jewish community in terms of telling their stories, but women and trans folks, it's not as widely done. And it's a huge part of history. There's this incredible book called The Rainbow Thread, and it's an examination of different queer Jewish texts, religious and non. Some of it's like letters, poetry, etc. Over, I forgot what the time frame, but it's at least like over the last 500 years. And it's incredible to find the amount of lesbian poetry about the investigation of gender identity within poems and letters to friends and lovers. So I think it's incredible that you are also investigating this in a very, very classic tale.
Well, thank you so much. I think it is so important. I mean, there are like those, this is a mom thought, but there are those PJ Library books that, like, when you're pregnant or just had a Jewish baby, they get you to sign up when you're so tired. And then they send you like a Jewish storybook a month, and they're great. And it's now that Haley's reading too, it's really fun to share them with her. But my friend who's gay is like reading them to her daughter, and she's like, none of these families look like ours.
Yeah.
Like, I was excited that like the girls look like Haley and had dark hair, you know, but like at that next level, like there's no two mom PJ Library book, you know, like, and so I was like, oh right, like we do need to really like valiantly put this out there more. I'm gonna look up this book you mentioned. It sounds great.
Oh yeah, I'll send it to you.
Please do.
I have one last question for you as we wrap up this interview. And we've talked about it a little bit in terms of like being out in the world, being a Jewish person, sometimes having to actually be the Jewish person in the room explaining the tradition, playing the game of telephone. But when you are out in public theater circles, do you identify yourself as a Jewish theater maker?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no situation where I wouldn't. I'd say, I don't know that, you know, We All Fall Down and Dybbuk are so rooted in Judaism, and they're the last two plays I've worked on. So it's kind of in the air of working on it, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's an essential part of who I am. And I think just like explaining that I'm queer, explaining that I'm Jewish gives other people space to also identify themselves in all the ways they need and want to. You know, I'm aware that I have a lot of privilege as like, you know, a white woman walking around in the world. And so one of the things I'm trying to do is model my experience as being more complex, more in the hopes that it'll open up some space for everybody else to do that too.
Definitely. Yeah. I completely agree with that. Self-identifying allows other people to self-identify too, which is a really freeing space to be. Offering up that kind of vulnerability to somebody, especially if you've just met them, is like, I'm a safe space, right? I think that's the message it sends.
Well, and it also, you know, sometimes when I'm not quite brave enough to do something, I think about my daughter and I'm like, this is the world I want her to see, you know, like in her school, like she's seven, they know about pronouns, they know, but they're so chill about all these things that grownups are so worked up about, you know, and I think it's so beautiful that maybe, you know, obviously there's a lot of chaos and strife, but maybe in these pockets, things are starting to open up and change, which I find exciting and hope and giving me hope.
Yeah, the next generation is definitely giving me a lot of hope in their like knowledge and understanding of other people's identities and what different kinds of people look like, but also like in their emotional intelligence. It's incredible that has improved so much in schools.
Yeah.
It's really nice. Yeah. This is such a wonderful conversation today, Lila. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Danielle. I think we should talk every week. This is wonderful.
I totally agree. And thank you, listeners. I didn't forget about you for tuning into Theater Schmooze. A special thanks to Danny Debner, our technical producer, Ilya Levinson and Alex Kaufman, the composers of our theme music, Michelle Shapiro, the creator of our logo, and the entire Alliance for Jewish Theater community. This podcast was brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater. If you like what you've heard today, support this podcast and all of our initiatives towards connecting Jewish theater makers by making a tax-deductible donation to Alliance for Jewish Theater at alljewishtheater.org or joining as a member. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes and learn more about us at alljewishtheater.org. I'm your host, Danielle Levski, and I'll chat with you next time. L'chaim.